You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson and Cordelia Lynch.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a check of the top global news stories with Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Oscar, what have you got?
Our theme today is war and protest. UK cosmologist Professor Stephen Hawking withdraws from a high-profile Israeli conference.
All right, look forward to that. Thank you, Oscar. And connecting Kenya to its neighbours, we'll be getting the latest on a $25 billion rail project.
They want to put close to 1,000 miles of road and railway line and oil pipeline across the largely neglected north of the country at a cost of something like $25 billion.
Also, part four of our Hong Kong culture series. We preview the forthcoming Art Basel, taking the island by storm later this month.
50% of the galleries in Art Basel in June in Switzerland come from Europe. And in Miami Beach in December, 50% of the galleries come from the Americas. So each fair has its unique identity and its unique flavour.
All that, plus we'll be playing some music too, all in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, let's get a wrap of the world news with David Spencer.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. A 52-year-old man due in court in the United States today, accused of the kidnapping and rape of three women rescued from a house in Cleveland, Ohio this week. The three had gone missing in the early 2000s. Ariel Castro is the owner of the house where they had allegedly been held. His two brothers, Pedro and Onel, have been released without charge. One of the women remains in hospital. Prosecutor Victor Perez has been revealing more details about their captivity.
The only opportunity after interviewing the young ladies to escape was the other day when Amanda escaped. So they were in that home. They don't believe that they've been outside of the home for the last 10 years, respectively.
At least eight people have been killed in a fire at a clothing factory in Bangladesh. The blaze in an industrial district of Dhaka comes amid greater scrutiny of safety standards in the country's garment industry following the collapse of Rana Plaza, in which more than 900 people are now known to have died. Several factories have been shut down following the tragedy, and demonstrations have taken place calling for better conditions for workers. A top US official who was in Libya at the time of last year's fatal attack on the country's mission in Benghazi has given the first public account of the incident. Gregory Hicks described the events that led to four Americans, including US Ambassador Christopher Stevens, being killed on the 11th of September. Mr. Hicks, who was in Tripoli at the time, said he was troubled after the incident by claims in America that the attack was a reaction to an extremist video. Some Republicans accused the White House of hiding information. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney says Wednesday's committee hearings are an attempt by Republicans to politicize the tragedy.
What happened in Benghazi was a tragedy, and the president has been committed from day one to two things, making sure that those who are responsible for the deaths of four Americans are found and brought to justice, and that we do everything we need to do to ensure that this kind of attack cannot happen again.
The Dutch Economic Affairs Ministry says there is no national shortage of baby formula, despite an investigation into a shortage of certain brands. There is also a probe into potentially illegal exports to China. Milk scandals in China have led to a shortage of local brands there, with families willing to pay a premium for imports. Hong Kong, Australia, and the UK have set limits on the sale of baby formula. The man tipped to be Pakistan's next prime minister says he will end involvement in the US-led war on terror. Nawaz Sharif says the move would be necessary for there to be peace in Pakistan. Voters go to the polls on Saturday. An 83-year-old Catholic nun has been convicted of breaking into a US nuclear defense facility. Sister Megan Rice and two other peace activists bore into the complex in Tennessee, which processes and stores enriched uranium. The break-in in July last year embarrassed officials and prompted a change in security measures. Sister Megan smiled at the verdict and said her only regret was taking 70 years to take action. The three will be sentenced later today. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. It's 5 minutes past eight here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You are indeed listening to Midori House live from Studio One. Just before we get started, Cordelia, I wanted to, because you've never worked here before, have you?
It's no, first day.
First day.
Very exciting.
Very nice to have you here. And I looked up your name, Cordelia, which means heartfelt.
Let's hope I can live up to that.
Named after Queen Cordelia or Cordelia Brideshead Revisited.
It's King Lear. Yeah, my mother's favourite. So
You're more like her than the Cordelia in Brideshead Revisited because you like playing basketball, and I can't imagine Cordelia in Brideshead Revisited being a basketball player.
No, not in this universe. I don't think so.
You're a professional basketball player, no less. Now, we're going to start the show with our agenda setter, and today we're joined by Oscar Guardiola Rivera, who is the author and senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University. You're bringing us all the stories we need to know about for the next 24 hours. Thank you very much for joining us, Oscar. We're going to start with an Israeli conference that has suddenly lost an important guest.
Before that, I like Queen Cordelia, basketball player.
We all like Queen Cordelia, the basketball player.
It's yes. A lot to live up to this now.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen Hawking made the headlines yesterday when he decided to withdraw from a high-profile Israeli conference in support of an academic boycott of the country. Initially, he had planned to speak at the event in June, but pulled out following advice from Palestinian academics.
And we move on also to a diplomatic push on the Syrian conflict between the US and Russia. How significant do you think that is?
That is going to be quite significant. Russia and the United States announced on Tuesday that they would seek to convene an international conference within weeks. It aims at ending the civil war in Syria. And this is the first time we have a joint effort by, these two camps, which usually do not see eye to eye in this conflict, to try and peacefully settle it. I mean, the country has taken more than 70,000 lives. It has left millions displaced and desperate. Everybody's saying now that even trying to intervene at this point, it might be too late because there is no clarity whatsoever about, who are the warring parties. There are increasing concerns about, Islamic fundamentalist groups taking the lead in the opposition. So this is, after John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov met earlier this week, this is a step forward. Obviously, everybody's very cautious about the possible results because the big challenge is to have Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, to attend the conference. But it seems to be an interesting development.
And do you think there's a bit of a face-saving exercise going on here? Because if a solution is brokered and it involves both Russia and the United States, it's very difficult at this stage for Russia to say, actually, the rebels are right. We agree all of a sudden that Bashar al-Assad has to go. They've been saying, no, he mustn't go for these last 24 months, and 70,000 people have died in the process. So any solution ultimately has got to involve Russia in some shape or form, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It is true that so far the Russians have steered clear of supporting regime change. They see it as unnecessary. But the Russian government has also said that it is not necessarily bound to Mr. Assad's political survival as part of a solution. So here we have an important U-turn on the part of Russia.
And of course, this next development throws up the critical question around foreign intervention, something Russia has always opposed.
Russia has said that it might be persuaded by a model case if it is demonstrated that the Syrian government used nervous gas and so on. But since the evidence on that is still neither here nor there, the UN has been very cautious. He had said that actually the opposition may have used gas. Well, it is time to step back and see if a possible peaceful solution is still in the cards.
And of course, Russia's got a pretty vested interest in all of this. It's got its fleet at Tartus in Syria, and of course, it does not want to see its friend in the region. It's one of its few friends in the region fall.
That is true. Now, at this point, everybody has an interest in a peaceful solution. It is recognized that for a foreign intervention, you would need close to 160,000 troops on the ground just to police a possible post-conflict solution. And everybody recognizes that this could go as bad as Afghanistan, if not worse. So everybody is interested in achieving some sort of solution alternative to, going to full military intervention.
And we move across the world to Latin America and a lack of diplomacy here. Former Colombian President Alvaro Uribe says he wants to take the Venezuelan president to court.
The aftermath of Venezuela's presidential elections is, threatening to become a bad Latin American soap opera. First, Maduro accused former Colombian president of plotting to overthrow him or else assassinate him. And now Alvaro Uribe retorts by threatening to take him to court. The paradox here is that Alvaro Uribe has in the past been linked to the notorious far-right Colombian paramilitary. And in fact, the court that he now would appeal to in order to seek protection has systematically decided against him or members of his government, precisely giving security protections to journalists who were threatened by him personally on television during his government. So that would be an interesting turn of events. Having said that, it is also the case that insofar as the rest of Latin America is concerned, there are rules in place in order to solve this conflict, just as there were rules in the case of the United States when none of the parties got enough votes earlier in the century, and the same here with hung parliaments. So they want this to be resolved internally, and nobody's interested in allowing this to escalate.
And of course, Maduro came to power on a very thin margin indeed. How much do you think that's a factor in his nervousness and aggression towards different factions? He seems to be waging war against a lot of sectors at the moment.
Well, he's nervous for two reasons. First, because the margin was very small, 1.49%. And of course, the second reason is that allows members of the opposition and also foreign interests to paint his administration as illegitimate. But again, I mean, we must remember that we wouldn't say that, the Bush Jr. administration after the Supreme Court decision was illegitimate, even though we all knew that there were more members, more Republicans in the Supreme Court. Same here with the hung parliament. So the point is whether or not it is viable to meddle in the country's affairs.
And he's a great towering giant of a man, isn't he, Nicolas Maduro? I don't expect he's having too much trouble sleeping with the threat of Mr. Uribe just across the border, is he?
I don't think so. He's very big and his moustache is very scary.
Indeed it is. I certainly wouldn't mess with Nicolas Maduro. He's in every photo call you see, he's sort of about a foot taller than everyone else present. Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Thank you for bringing us up to speed.
Coming up, is Kenya's lunatic rail being reinvigorated in Africa? We'll have the latest from Nairobi.
Switzerland is the natural home of timekeeping and host to Baselworld, the most important international platform for the business of watchmaking. Monocle dispatched a film crew to investigate this year's innovation.
Baselworld attracts everybody from every tiny niche of the watch industry as a whole, and that can be somebody who buys components, somebody who sells completed watches, somebody who sells watch cases, somebody who writes about watches, and you can't really miss it.
Horological showmanship at the Basel Fairground. Check out our film on monocle.com.
In the 19th century, Kenya's lunatic rail, so-called because it seemed like a mad dream realised at the expense of lives and large amounts of funding, was the railway infrastructure that helped make Nairobi the bustling modern city it is today. Well, Kenya has another such infrastructure project up its sleeve to boost the regional economy.
And reportedly costing around $25 billion, authorities in Nairobi are planning to connect the sleepy seaside town of Lamu with South Sudan and Ethiopia, turning it into a regional trade hub, a transport and oil hub as well. Well, our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke to Tristan McConnell, our correspondent in Nairobi, to find out more about these developments.
It's certainly big, it's certainly ambitious. I mean, we're talking, it's a colossal sum of money that they're talking about spending on this infrastructure project. They want to put close to 1,000 miles of road and railway line and oil pipeline across the largely neglected north of the country at a cost of something like $25 billion. So it's certainly thinking big, and the hope for Kenya is that it will help to boost not just Kenya's economy, but also the regional economy by linking Kenya into its landlocked northern neighbours, Ethiopia and South Sudan.
Now, if we look at the railway, the original railway that was built in Kenya was nicknamed the Lunatic Express due to its cost, its budget overruns, and also the number of people that were eaten by lions while trying to build it. Any fears that this might be the Lunatic Express Mark II?
Well, I think when I was talking to Kenyan officials involved in the project, the way that they sought to compare what they're calling the Lamu Corridor with, as you mentioned, the Lunatic Express, is in the way that it really opened up the economy and kind of transformed Kenya. Because, you know, Nairobi, a little over 100 years ago, was a couple of wooden shacks by a railway depot, and now it's a city of 3 million people, and it's very much, you know, the heart of East Africa's economy, and they hope it'll do something similar. There are, of course, worries with something on this scale that it could become, you know, a white elephant and fail to work. I don't think we're going to see people eaten by lions and dropping dead from tsetse fly and malaria and whatnot like happened in the colonial project. But it could, you know, fail to work. But the officials that I spoke to were very keen to point out that they have strong political support and they're gaining the kind of financial support that's going to be needed to make this happen. So they're very optimistic that it's going to go forward.
You mentioned financial support. Just outline to us where the money for this project is likely to come from.
Well, some of it obviously is going to come from the budgets of the regional countries, so Kenya, Ethiopia and South Sudan, but they can't afford to pay for all of it. The people that they're having discussions with at the moment is, unsurprisingly, China. That's Chinese state companies who are responsible for building roads at the moment all over Kenya and have contracts for things like expanding the port at Mombasa, that's the existing port, as well as overhauling the original Lunatic Express Railway. And they have signed at least a beginning deal to do the first three berths at Lamu Port itself. So China is somewhere that Kenya is hoping to find cash. It's also talking to the likes of the World Bank, the African Development Bank. So it's looking for institutional funding, bilateral funding from other states, and also to debt funding and private companies.
And just finally, let's talk about Lamu itself. It's one of the most beautiful spots on the Indian Ocean coast, attracts enormous amount of tourists every year, and it's relatively unspoilt. You know, until recently, there was only one car allowed in Lamu, and that was the district commissioner, if you wanted to get around. Other than that, it was donkey cart or bicycle. This project, if it does go ahead, is obviously going to dramatically change that area, isn't it?
It certainly is, and there are big worries locally about that. The people involved in actually trying to make the Lamu Corridor project happen, you know, insist that they will minimise environmental damage, but they also admit that, you know, a project like this cannot happen without causing some damage to the environment. And that's really worrying to the people of Lamu, who rely almost entirely on basically fishing and tourism. And both of those face, you know, an uncertain future when you're talking about building an immense port right next door to it. Now, the port isn't actually going to be built on top of Lamu Island. It's not quite that bad. But, I mean, if you think about it, who's really going to want to spend, you know, $500 a night to stay in, you know, their idyllic, secluded beach hotel, and they look out across the ocean and see an oil tanker chugging by? And, of course, the other side of this is that it's almost impossible to have a large port without some degree of pollution. Whether that's tearing up the mangrove swamps or accidental oil spills, it's impossible to see this happening without some environmental damage, and that's really worrying for the people of Lamu.
And Tristan McAllister, our transports editor, also joins us to reflect on the broader questions of East African transport infrastructure. Hi there, Tristan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, very well, thank you. What sort of connectivity What will it do to connectivity in Africa in general?
I think in general, you look at a picture in Africa that is pretty chopped up. You have a lot of borders that divide countries where roads, maybe haphazard roads cross, but you don't have a lot of rail. You don't have beyond single lane roads much of a way to get between countries. And then beyond that too, you have a fledgling air transport infrastructure that it really doesn't take care of what it should. And a lot of people have to actually, to get from country to country, sometimes next to one another, have to fly to Europe to get back to Africa. So I think something like a massive infrastructure project, railroad, whatever else, could significantly change the face of Africa, not only in terms of social mobility, but economic mobility as well.
Interesting. There's scarcely a single massive infrastructure project in Africa that doesn't have, in some shape or form, the involvement of the Chinese. And that's the case with this project, too.
It is, and I think, you know, not surprised by this one at all, that, you know, last month or 2 months ago in Nigeria, the Chinese were hot to trot on a bunch of airport projects, infrastructure projects, and now we're seeing them pop up in a place like Kenya, Uganda. I mean, I think it makes complete sense. It's a total play in terms of resource grab, and they want to be the friend in the back pocket when they discover new resources in places like South Sudan and places like northern Uganda. And so it's very, very clear that there's strategic interest there, and it just falls in line with, like I said, places like Nigeria, but also places like Sri Lanka, where the Chinese are building airports, and it's just par for the course.
There are, of course, examples of a hasty interest in transport infrastructure in history, aren't there?
Yeah, many. And I think one that really stands out, one that I think is pretty prominent this year, is the Panama Canal. Right now, they're in the process of widening it so that bigger ships can get through it. But beyond that, the United States had a very strong interest in making sure the Panama Canal was secured as far as a transport corridor. The French saw it before that as a real strong strategic point. They weren't able to see it through, didn't finish the canal. The Americans did. And lo and behold, this many years later, you know, 100 years later, we're seeing a canal that, while it's controlled by Panama, the United States wouldn't let much happen to it. And at this point, the United States essentially has a first right of refusal in terms of access for wartime or any other strategic interests. So, you know, it's part of the world developing and seeing how things work out. And as the political, you know, paradigm shifts and power shifts to Asia, it's clear that Africa is clearly in their sights.
Well, let's hope that project brings huge economic developments to the people there as well. Thank you very much indeed, Tristan McAllister, our transport editor, and before that, Tristan McConnell in Nairobi. Thank you both for bringing us up to speed. Now, changing gears quite dramatically now, from feathers to fetishism. The world of trend forecasting is a broad and pretty dynamic field to work in, and this month, one of Europe's top fashion spotters and trend soothsayers, Lidové Edelcourt, is busy promoting a huge exhibition to open later this year, called Fetishism in Fashion. That's at the Mood Biennale in Arnhem in the Netherlands.
Yes, despite its niche, marginalised and often still shocking status, Fetishism can be seen as a tradition that has inspired wardrobes and catwalks far and beyond the sleazier side of life. In a peaceful and suitably luxuriant London hotel room, Monocle's David Pleasant met the Dutch figurehead and taught leather, textiles and cushions.
My name is Lidewij Edelkort. I'm born in the Netherlands, that's why I have this name. And I'm a forecaster of trends and lifestyles. And I'm also a curator of design and fashion.
And what will you be presenting at Amsterdam and then later at Arnhem this month?
It's all related. First I do a survey in what design can do, and then this is about the Biennale, which opens on the 8th of June until the 21st of July. The city of Arnhem is not so far from Amsterdam. It's only an hour by train. It's the city where there is the art school Artes, which has the famous fashion department, where I was also educated. So it's all sort of a sentimental journey going back home. And when I was asked to curate this Biennale, I decided to pick the idea of fetishism in fashion and try to understand what it is all about, where it is going. It has been influencing fashion since the 70s, actually, but it became really strong in the 80s with Montana, Mugler, and so on, where it was lots of leather. It was the period of the emancipation of the gay movement. So at that point, clothes became very assertive and with lots of bondage and lots of mean detailing. And you see this again now, coming back this week. It was the punk show in New York, and although nobody really still knows what is punk, you could see that there were still these influences going strong. But there is a more general idea on fetishism, where it is the bonds we have with our objects. All the people with the good luck bracelets, you know, the thousands of good luck bracelets in the world, the lockers in Paris on the bridge, where you just, you know, declare your love and then it's formalized by a fetish. The idea of fetishism also in a more anthropological context, so the more shamanistic and animistic objects and outfits and textiles and feathers and ropes and grasses and almost a more ecological aspect of the fetishism. So it's a very, very, very vast domain. And the more I've been studying, the more I came to this very amazing discoveries about what it's really going to give us.
You mentioned kind of that your work researching textiles, and a couple of years ago you spoke at length and curated a show on textiles at the Salone. Tell us a little bit about that and how that has progressed and your feelings on the world of textiles and how it can kind of transgress that kind of industrial notion to something more adaptive. Is that still something that interests you?
Yeah, we continue to do work on talking textiles because it's still very necessary. You know that we might live without textile if we don't save it soon. And trends do indicate that we really want to surround ourselves with more textile-driven design. So there's more carpets, there's more rugs, there's more mats, there's poofs, cushions, even curtains coming back in new ways. So there is an upholstery, of course, of furniture, which was almost gone and suddenly is making a remarkable comeback, with even sometimes clothes for your furniture. So it's like separate pieces you can pull over your chairs. So I'm very happy to see that there is more and more of it. And I believe that it is really related to this idea to want to be more nomadic, live more close to the floor, more at ease, have less furniture in a way, and more small items which you can carry around. So I can only see that textile will grow. It's an expression of our need together, forces to be together, to share, to somehow mend, I would say, the textile of society.
You're already giving us some insights and some tips about what you think the future will hold, but it would be good to know a little bit more about what's involved in the world or the daily life of a trend or fashion forecaster. It's quite a mysterious concept for somebody who maybe doesn't know. And are there any methods? Do you go through, do you have a kind of set way of going about predicting future trends, or is it something that's more emotional and that just kind of comes to you?
It's actually a combination of rational thinking and emotional and intuitive feeling. So I have learned to make my intuition work almost on its own. It's always observing whatever happens, and I somehow seem to be able to analyze and sort of archive little fragments of ideas and givens in society already. And when you have critical mass of all these fragments at one point, it knocks on your brain and says, you know, I've got news. There is this word, or there is this idea, or this color, or this notion, or this sphere, this aura, whatever comes up, that announces itself to me, in a way. So I'm, in a way, a sort of transmitter, you can say. So I'm catching it. I'm like radio.
And that was Lidové Edelcourt talking to our very own David Pleasant there.
Coming up in the next half hour of the programme, we preview a report from this week's Urbanist and under the spotlight, Urban Monstrosities. And we'll continue our series looking at the Hong Kong cultural scene. Today we preview Hong Kong's first Art Basel.
50% of the galleries in Art Basel in June in Switzerland come from Europe. And in Miami Beach in December, 50% of the galleries come from the Americas. So each fair has its unique identity and its unique flavour.
So plenty to come in the next half hour. But first, here's David Spencer with a wrap of the world headlines.
Thank you. A 52-year-old man's due in court in the United States today, accused of the kidnapping and rape of three women rescued from a house in Cleveland, Ohio this week. The three had gone missing in the early 2000s. Ariel Castro is the owner of the house where they had allegedly been held. His two brothers, Pedro and Onil, have been released without charge. At least eight people have been killed in a fire at a clothing factory in Bangladesh. The blaze in an industrial district of Dhaka comes amid greater scrutiny of safety standards in the country's garment industry following the collapse of Rana Plaza, in which more than 900 people are now known to have died. A top US official who was in Libya at the time of last year's fatal attack on the country's mission in Benghazi has given the first public account of the incident. Gregory Hicks described the events that led to four Americans, including US Ambassador Christopher Stevens, being killed on the 11th of September. An investigation is underway in the Netherlands into a shortage of certain brands of baby formula and into claims of illegal exports to China. Milk scandals in China have led to a shortage of local brands, with families willing to pay a premium for imports. The man tipped to win this weekend's Pakistan general election says he'll end involvement in the US-led war on terror. Nawaz Sharif says the move would be necessary for there to be peace in Pakistan. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Burgess-Watson, and Cordelia Lynch. Now, for this week's Urbanist, Andrew Tuck and team explore the idea of monstrosities in cities, from unfinished viaducts in Vancouver to slums of Nairobi. The show will take a look at bungled infrastructure and ugly buildings. How does a city overcome them?
To preview the episode, here's a chat between Urbanist producer David Michon and Monocle's design editor Hugo MacDonald on what goes wrong, or indeed right, when cities opt for making their architecture iconic.
Monstrosity in architecture is something that is often associated with shock, and when buildings are first unveiled to the public, or it's very hard to keep a building hidden from the public while it's going up, because they more often than not take at least months and often years, particularly when they're huge and potentially monstrous in scale. So people focus on the politics surrounding the building, what the building represents and how much the building costs. And you have all of that back context that goes into the way that local people and people around the world, critics, architecture enthusiasts, anybody who might have an interest in what that building looks like before the hoardings are taken down and the building is revealed. So if I were to pinpoint, say, the Sydney Opera House, you might look aghast at me for saying that that was a monstrosity. But such was the scandal surrounding its design and how much it cost and the whole wrangling process of actually getting it up, that it was considered as a complete monstrosity and a complete failure in many ways. We look at it now as perhaps one of the most successful monstrosities in architecture. It's certainly one of the most photographed buildings in the world. It's definitely the most visited tourist attraction in Australia, and you cannot help but be completely blown away by it when you go and see it.
And, you know, in the case of the Sydney Opera House, for example, how does it make that transformation from something that is just kind of maybe a bit more abstract and kind of completely criticized and controversial to something that's probably one of the most beloved symbols of a country?
Well, what's interesting is it takes time for a building to settle into its city and its surroundings. And one of the frequent criticisms of the Opera House was it had really nothing to do with Sydney or the city. It wasn't built by an Australian architect. It was built by Jørn Utzon, the Danish architect. He fell out massively with the commissioning body, and it ended up, as most buildings do, costing far more than anybody had ever anticipated it would. But once you get up to it, and once the city had sort of slightly forgotten all of those things, which can take years in itself, you realise this is a building that is an extraordinary, it's much more than a building. It's a, like you said, symbol of a nation's hope and creative sort of verve, in the case of the Sydney Opera House. It's an extraordinary achievement in engineering as well as imagination. And you don't even have to be an architect or an architectural, somebody who knows about architecture, to go up to it and just be completely blown away by what a beautiful structure it is.
I'm wondering if there's a difference between, you know, the kind of criteria by which the public judges a building and the criteria by which, you know, people who are in the architecture industry judge a building. Would they consider the same buildings, you know, a monstrosity? And your list here, are these buildings, you know, kind of universally, you know, considered monstrosities when they're first proposed? Or is there kind of a
It does tend to, I mean, opinion divides, obviously. I wanted to go next to the Guangzhou Opera House, which were opened in 2010 by Zaha Hadid. And really, for the majority of people, put this second-tier Chinese city on the map. It's the third biggest performance space in China. And built by Zaha Hadid, it doesn't look like a traditional opera house. Not that there is necessarily a traditional vernacular for an opera house, but it looks like two pebbles shoved together. People who know Zaha's work and people who are familiar with what she does with her architecture would probably think, well, this is a beautiful building. It just happens to be sort of in a city that Zaha has no connection with and probably hasn't visited very much in the process of it being constructed. People who don't know about architecture would think, well, that is the monstrosity built in an ancient Chinese city. Again, it has no, doesn't speak to the local architectural vernacular in any way. It doesn't really add much to the quality of life. The people who have to now live with this building, all it is it spawns a million postcards and a lot of sort of new tourists, which is a good thing. But for much of the local Chinese population in Guangzhou, who looked to Frank Gehry's Guggenheim in Bilbao and saw initially the positive effects, but then also the negative effects of having a monumental structure that is plonked in the middle of your city.
So if you put down a very modern building in an old city, you know, obviously that is one reason why people might consider it just unreasonable almost, and thus kind of an eyesore and a monstrosity in a city. And how do you overcome a context that's so ingrained in the fabric of the city?
Well, that's part of the difficulty. And you always think you can't please everyone. And in some cases, you really can't please anyone for certainly some length of time until it slowly creeps into the hearts of the people who live with it. Because there's nothing worse than a pastiche of a new building trying to fit in with too much or too many obvious references to local architecture. In many ways, it is good just to go completely the other way, particularly with a building like an opera house or an art gallery or something that is a cultural object and a symbol in itself. So I'm always divided in two ways. It's very easy instantly to look at pictures of something like the Guangzhou Opera House when it opens and you see it surrounded and you think, that's just monstrous. How dare someone like Zaha come in and spend this money and build something.
And kind of impose a particular philosophy about
Impose something that you feel is more about leaving her stamp than about contributing to the future urban fabric of Guangzhou in itself. But then 10 years from now, we'll look at it and probably feel very similar to it as the Sydney Opera House does as well.
And do you think that's partially because of a drive to have something iconic in a city where people, the people who are commissioning the project, hope for something that stands out, you know, so blatantly?
Definitely. And that is why so many monstrous or iconic, you know, the two words are completely interlinked, architecture projects get built, and more so now than ever. It's a badge of a city's sort of turning point in its fortunes, particularly smaller cities that might sort of be suffering some faded glory. If they can have a new building commissioned that makes everybody say, oh, look, we've forgotten about that. Look what's happening there. And they've got enough money, or there's a body there with enough money to commission a top architect to design a building that is going to not just attract tourists, but also attract potential investment further down the line from people who think that this is a place worth visiting and worth spending money and time in.
And that was Monocle's Hugo MacDonald talking urban monstrosities there with David Michon for this week's edition of The Urbanist. And to hear the full conversation, tune in tonight at 1900 London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with the fourth instalment of our Hong Kong cultural series. Today we look at the first Art Basel on the island.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
Just after 20 to 9 in the morning here in London. Now, this month sees the first Art Basel Contemporary Art Fair in Asia. It's opening on the 23rd of May at the Hong Kong Convention Centre. And to round off our week of culture from Hong Kong, we've got a two-part report on what that fair will bring to the city.
For today's first instalment, our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears, speaks with the fair's director and local gallery director about what Art Basel can bring to Hong Kong.
Think of a contemporary art fair and it's hard for Art Basel not to come to mind. Founded by three Swiss gallerists in 1970, the organisation launched the Miami edition of their fair in 2002, and this year will debut Art Basel Hong Kong in the city's convention centre at the end of May. Having helped transform Miami from a seaside resort town into a hub for both North and Latin American art and design, Art Basel looks set to do the same for the Asian market from Hong Kong. But the Art Basel team isn't coming into a contemporary art fair void. Established in 2008, Art Hong Kong already had international collectors and gallerists visiting the city at the end of May, before being acquired by Art Basel. Magnus Renfrew was the fair director of Art Hong Kong, and now heads up Art Basel in Asia. For him, it's important to see a sense of continuity between the two shows.
Before we go on to the changes, I think it's really important to emphasise what's going to remain the same. I think that's as important. I think that there was initially a concern that when Art Basel acquired the fair, that it would become a copy-paste version of Art Basel. And when we announced the list of galleries this year in January, there was a very positive response that over 50% of the galleries come from Asia and the Asia-Pacific region. And that's really in keeping with the other Art Basel fairs, both in Basel in Switzerland and in Miami Beach, in that 50% of the galleries in Art Basel in June in Switzerland come from Europe. And in Miami Beach in December, 50% of the galleries come from the Americas, so from North America and South America. So the approach is the same, if you like, that it's the very strongest international galleries from around the world in the context of the most important galleries from the region. So each fair has its unique identity and its unique flavour. My previous role was fair director of Art HK, and I was the director of the fair from its inception in 2008 till the fifth and final edition last year. I think that Art Basel looked to acquire the fair and to set up a fair in Hong Kong for the same reasons that we did. There are many reasons why Hong Kong makes a lot of sense as a location for a major international hub fair. Factors like the fact that there's no tax on the import and export of art, there's no sales tax, there is freedom of expression is protected under the basic law of Hong Kong and the Hong Kong Constitution. Its geographical location, right at the heart of Asia, and its shared history with the West means that English is commonly spoken. It's a very easy place to get around. And there's probably nowhere in the world where people from both Asia and from the West feel so equally at home.
With international galleries like London's White Cube, Paris's Galerie Perrotin, and New York's Lehman Maupin all having set up permanent posts here in Hong Kong, it's clear that the city can attract a good collector base. Althea Viaforacres is the International Director of Pearl Lam Galleries, which already operates spaces in Hong Kong and Shanghai, and will open in Singapore later this year. For her, a fair like Art Basel isn't just about attracting new collectors.
I see Art Basel as being an organization that helps educate a public. And not only do they educate a public, but they also contribute to the professionalism of the galleries themselves. So you bring together an organization, the professional galleries, and an audience that's inherently a part of a community. You develop a personality that's unique to a place in itself. On top of that, we then have the destination travelers, the cultural travelers, who then bring a very cosmopolitan expertise. And they look, they see, they're rather commercial. They're usually collectors on a very high level. And that offers a dialogue that we wouldn't have otherwise.
In a city with a lot of money, but few public contemporary art institutions, Art Basel Hong Kong will have to be more than just an art fair. As Magnus explains, it's an event that will help anchor a community hungry for more contemporary art.
It's an event that has a certain critical mass, so it's able to attract attention and put a focus on what's happening in the city and what's happening in the region around the time of the fair. And we've embraced that. We work with a number of partner organisations and non-profit organisations who do great work here 365 days a year, and we help to promote their activities to our international VIPs who are attending, and also the press that we fly in for the event. So we hope that we're making a contribution in that respect. The visitor numbers during the 5 years that ArtHK took place grew from 19,000 visitors in 2008 to 67,000 visitors in the fifth and final edition last year in 2012. And it really shows that there's a great hunger for an event like this and the opportunity to see modern and contemporary art. I think that it certainly has been performing a cultural function as well as a commercial function. It's been a great opportunity for people to see art from right around the world. And that's been an opportunity that's not been available historically elsewhere in Hong Kong. That's set to change with the opening of West Kowloon in 2017. The curators at West Kowloon are already organising temporary exhibitions, and last weekend, for example, the inflatable works on the site of West Kowloon attracted an audience of 36,000 in a single weekend. So it really goes to show that there is a great interest and a great hunger for the opportunity to see modern and contemporary art in Hong Kong.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Aisha Spears.
Fascinating stuff. And tomorrow we'll have more from Art Basel. The last in our Hong Kong cultural series explores how the contemporary art scene in Hong Kong is set to change.
Well, in just a moment, we'll be getting a check of what's making the front pages of the Italian press. But before that, time for a song. This is Beirut with the aptly named Postcards from Italy.
Times we had, oh, when the wind would blow.
And that was Beirut with Postcards from Italy.
Now it's time for a roundup of today's Italian newspapers. And for this job, we're joined by Monocle's researcher, David Pleasant. Hello to you.
Hello.
And we start with Berlusconi's conviction for tax fraud. An appeal court has upheld that. Of course, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison. But this isn't the end of the story, is it?
No, not at all. His lawyers have said this morning that that was expected. No surprises there. It's all part of their strategy. And the next step is to go to the Court of Cassation in Rome, which is the highest court. This was the appeals court of Milan that made this verdict. The Court of Cassation will be the next process. God knows how many years that will take. Well, actually, we have some time frame. The crux of the matter is that there's going to be a time limit on this whole case, and he's very unlikely to be able to go to prison at all for this sentence.
Mm, it's amazing, isn't it, how he every single time manages to dodge the bullet. It's incredible, and a real story of survival there. So not likely to go to prison, but lots of other cases lingering in the background.
Yeah, that's right. There's the sex, the underage sex allegation with Ruby, the Moroccan Italian. So, I mean, basically, the main story is how the press and the public react to this and whether they kind of accept. I mean, it's just a constant dodging game by Berlusconi. Let's just see if there's going to be some kind of limit to what the public can take. I mean, he is technically not in government, obviously, but he's there by virtue of the grand coalition that has been set up with Letta. So, I mean, he's still very present in the public sphere.
Nevertheless, though, a kind of another significant legal blow for him.
Exactly. And although it was expected, I think it's just one more little kind of strike against him. Let's put it that way.
Now, one of his arch enemies, and he's got quite a few to choose from, is of course, Beppe Grillo from the Five Star Movement. He's been meeting all his parliamentarians in Rome, but is that movement sort of looking slightly in disarray now?
Well, yeah, I think the big kind of 2 weeks ago, when the government was being formed, the then head of the Democratic Party, Bersani, kind of reached out to them. They flatly refused to join in any kind of coalition. You know, he would have basically given them anything, including a president of the Republic. And they just refused to engage. And I think a lot of people have said that kind of just put them in, they're saying put them in the freezer, they're kind of frozen. So I think Beppe Grillo's trying to re-engage, trying to kind of get back on the headlines. They haven't even really been making much of the news lately. So he doesn't do many public meetings or certainly televised meetings. So he's now in Rome meeting the 100 or so parliamentarians. Amongst the main things that he's sorting out with them is the dispute over what they should be paid. Famously, they are only claiming half of what they're entitled to, quite honourable gesture. But there has been some scandal over how to exactly reimburse the state for the salaries that have already been paid out.
Because, of course, parliamentarians in Italy are notoriously well paid. I mean, there are all sorts of stories of provincial governors earning three times the British Prime Minister's annual salary in Italy. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really, it was quite a kind of admirable and kind of inspiring move by his parliamentarians. But I think there's some, everything goes in Italy, there are problems over exactly how they can limit the pay that they receive.
Moving on to another area of provincial politics, and of course the earthquake ravaged L'Aquila. The mayor there removing the Italian flags from all public buildings. How has that played out?
Yeah, this is a story in La Corriere della Sera. The mayor has said no one gives a damn about L'Aquila and has gone about removing the Italian flag, as you have said. The interesting thing is here that L'Aquila has kind of, it's been overshadowed by other earthquakes, other natural disasters that have happened in Italy, but there's still deep problems. The historic centre is virtually still closed. Most public buildings completely ravaged by an earthquake. Apparently, most people have now been rehoused, but there's still deep, deep problems for this, the regional capital of the Abruzzo region.
And do you think that
very visible public stance on it will make any difference to the campaign to get greater funding, to recover some of the area?
Well, interestingly, it's quite a political issue with Aquila. We may remember, you might remember that Berlusconi was quite heavily involved. This happened when he was Prime Minister, the earthquake 4 years ago. And he kind of ran in and kind of did this big kind of statesman campaign and kind of shook hands and met people in refugee camp, not the refugee, the temporary housing camps for the victims. So I think maybe the mayor is even calling back or calling the current Prime Minister or powers to kind of step up to the mark and perhaps act in a way that even that Berlusconi did.
It's a sad story for a high-profile city, which is actually, I just looked at it on a map, it's absolutely slap bang in the middle of the boot of Italy, very central, very visible. And a sad story there. We're going to have to leave it there, though. Thank you so much, David Pleasant, for talking us through all the Italian newspapers. And sadly, that brings us to the close of today's show. I'd like to thank our producer, Aled John, our researcher, Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, and Audrey Letendard, who's our researcher, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is Rob Bound, our culture editor, who'll be hosting the latest edition of Culture. Andrew Tuck and Sophie Grove will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.